One economic problem.
Two very different ideas to fix it.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, the first day of September.
Coming up, why are the ideas to fix the job market so different?
Apple gets accused of polluting air and water in China.
And a new idea to avoid following the law. Promised to bring thousands of jobs.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Labor Department said this morning that the number of people seeking first-time unemployment benefits fell last week to 409,000, which is good, but it's still quite a high number when you look at the last couple of years. And as we wait for tomorrow's big monthly employment report from the government, let's talk with Diane Swonk about jobs. She's chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Diane, we take this morning's weekly jobless claims number. Yesterday, we got a couple of numbers. What do they tell you about the job market that we're in right now?
Well, the job market, although we continue to generate jobs, remains tepid at best. And in fact, tomorrow's number that's printed by the payroll data will be weaker even than what we saw earlier in the week because of the Verizon strike that was not accounted for in earlier data. And in fact, we'll be lucky to hit the 50,000 threshold on private sector jobs, which is nothing to pop champagne corks over.
Nothing to pop champagne corks over. And next week, of course, we'll hear from President Obama, who's going to be offering a new jobs proposal. What do you expect he'll be able to do to fix the jobs problem?
Well, if there was any easy way to fix it, it would have already been fixed. The bottom line is what we're looking at is ways to sort of temper the pain that we're feeling and allow, when we're treading water, to keep our head above water. Extended payrolls, extended unemployment insurance. That doesn't generate a lot of jobs, but it keeps us from sinking through the water. We're not going to see much more than that. Everything's on the margins, and unfortunately, we don't have a lot of wiggle room anymore.
And, of course, President Obama, after yesterday's whole kerfuffle over the timing of his speech, it looks like he may have a problem getting anything through the Republican Congress to deal with the job situation. And I want to ask you, look at that, and then you look at the Fed, where we have sort of a divided Fed when they're trying to figure out what to do about economic growth. Why do we have such division in terms of economic thought right now?
Well, I think the real issue here is we're in uncertain and uncharted territory. And when you're in uncharted territory, everyone has a different view on the path out. None of them may be the exact right path out. And that's the problem, is it's legitimate to have debate when you're in such uncharted and unprecedented times.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Well, Jeremy, Diane, you both mentioned the president's speech next week, which we know is going to call for more investment in infrastructure. So we asked Marketplace's David Gura to look into how many jobs more federal funding of infrastructure could create.
It's not hard to find a bridge to repair, a dam to replace, or a road to repave. Robert Frank teaches economics at Cornell University.
This is one area where finding a useful job to do is just not a challenge.
Frank told me to look at an infrastructure report card the American Society of Civil Engineers put together a couple of years ago.
Bridges got a C, roads are a D-, transit is a D.
That's Kathy Caldwell, the group's president. Overall, U.S. infrastructure got a D. Caldwell says she and her colleagues have done some number crunching.
In general, $1 billion spent on the infrastructure creates 35,000 new jobs.
And Nobel Prize-winning economist Peter Diamond says there's no time like the present.
There's going to be big-time infrastructure spending sooner or later anyway.
Right now, interest rates are low, materials aren't that expensive. Diamond says we've got the opportunity to help our short-term problem, unemployment, without making our long-term problems worse. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, one place that was supposed to be a bright spot in the job market was the green energy sector. But the solar market, at least in one company's case, has turned very, very dark with the announcement Solyndra is shutting its doors.
Marketplace's Eve Troe is with us now in our Los Angeles studios with the latest on that story. Good morning, Eve.
Hey, good morning.
So what happened to Solyndra? Tell us a little bit about this company.
Well, it was a six-year-old. It was 6 years old, yeah. And it was a Silicon Valley startup, and it got over $500 million in loans from the Department of Energy, first under the Bush administration, and then President Obama kind of made a pet of it. It made it a case study for clean tech jobs. In fact, it got more government help as part of the stimulus package. Then yesterday, it fell hard and fast, closed the factory in Fremont, California, let go 1,100 workers, filed for bankruptcy. Now, you know, the government will be the first in line to get its money back as the company liquidates its assets. And I want to play you something from Rob Day. He's a clean tech investor with Black Coral Capital. He says Solyndra made this unique type of solar power system. They tried to cut out engineers and other middlemen you might need for solar power usually, but it was also more expensive, and that was likely behind the downfall.
This was a bold attempt at innovation, not just in how to make solar panels, but how to reinvent the entire solar value chain. And whenever you're making a bold attempt like that, not all of those efforts are going to work out for the best. Solyndra will probably become a political football when, in reality, it's really a special case.
That football is already being tossed around by some folks in the GOP today. They say government shouldn't be betting on individual startups like this.
All right. So, Eve, how is the solar power industry doing overall?
Well, it's looking good on paper. It's getting a lot more popular. More people are buying solar power systems for their houses, and even big box stores and factories are putting them in. There are these tax incentives that are driving those sales. But the jobs and sales, not so much in sync because of China. Chinese companies are making tons of cheap solar panels. People here are buying them. And then that makes the dilemma, right? Because even as solar power gets more popular here, the U.S. manufacturing sector doesn't get that big bump.
All right. Marketplace's Eve Tro from the Sustainability Desk. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
Now to the Justice Department's decision to block the proposed $39 billion merger of cell phone carriers AT&T and T-Mobile. It's been a while since we've had a big antitrust case in this country, and this one is expected to take months and cost millions of dollars. For more, let's bring in antitrust expert Dan Crane. He is a law professor at the University of Michigan, and he joins us from Ann Arbor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, once the Justice Department steps in like they did yesterday and opposes a big merger, how likely is it that the merger will eventually go through?
Well, it does depend upon the facts of the case, obviously. In this case, on paper, the Justice Department's case looks very strong. They have alleged, at least, that AT&T and T-Mobile would lead to a very strong increase in concentration in many local and the national market for wireless services.
And why do you think that this case raised the red flags for justice when, for instance, Google's acquisition of the travel site ITA didn't, or the Comcast acquisition of NBC Universal?
Well, this is a horizontal merger, meaning it's a merger between competitors. Unlike those other mergers you just mentioned, which were primarily vertical mergers, which means that the firms were not competitors. And this is a case involving a merger between the second and fourth largest firms in the market with a where the market has a total of four firms. So it's really a 4-3 merger, which traditionally would raise antitrust scrutiny.
So this is sort of a no-brainer.
Well, it's a no-brainer to bring the case. Obviously, there are nuances in the case. AT&T will have a theory that competition is primarily on a local market basis, and that if you look local market by local market, it's not so bad.
Do you think that this is a shift for the Obama administration, that they're now going to be tougher on big mergers and acquisitions?
They haven't challenged many mergers so far. There haven't been so many large horizontal mergers of this kind, though. So in my view, this is really business as usual for the antitrust agencies.
Dan Crane, law professor at the University of Michigan, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, Steve, while we're talking about this deal, the AT&T deal, let's talk about what seems to be a new trend for companies trying to get something from governments.
Yeah.
Yesterday, before the story broke that the Justice Department had some antitrust issues with the AT&T T-Mobile deal, there was a plea from AT&T.
Yeah.
Let the deal go through, and we will bring 5,000 jobs to the United States.
We were talking about this in the newsroom yesterday.
Indeed.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And in this morning's LA Times, there's news of a similar plea from Amazon, which wants to avoid collecting sales tax in California. Amazon is offering to hire 7,000 workers if it can avoid collecting those taxes.
Wow.
Well, while we're at it, Steve, I would like to say that I will hire 10,000 workers if I don't have to pay taxes.
Really?
But you have to give me the tax breaks first, and then I'll hire the workers. Okay?
Then you'll hire the workers. All right.
Trust me.
Shh.
show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective on business and economics. Russia said today it will officially recognize Libya's interim government. There's a conference today in Paris, by the way, that seeks to bolster political and financial support for that emerging government. The BBC's Jonathan Marcus is with us now from Paris, and he has the latest. Hi, Jonathan.
Yes, hi.
After the conference is concluded, how much cash and other aid could Libya get from the rest of the world?
It's not so much about raising money. What's happening at the moment is small amounts of frozen Libyan funds are being released by individual governments making applications to a UN committee. I think that's important, not least to begin to pay salaries of public service workers. To get all of the funds released, we're going to need a full-scale UN Security Council resolution. There are still some governments, not least the South Africans, who are a little bit sceptical about accepting that the Gaddafi regime is now a thing of the past.
I know reconstruction depends almost as much on rebuilding the oil industry, right? I mean, what's happening on that front in Libya?
Getting the oil industry back up and running is absolutely crucial. It depends to a large extent on foreign expertise. So clearly, the security situation is an important factor there. But I think this is one of the key differences between Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan. There isn't the level of destruction in Libya. This is not a country that is a potential basket case. It's a country that can pay to rebuild. Clearly, though, the crucial thing in the first instance is to end the fighting and really to run down the Gaddafi regime so that there is a definitive end to this conflict and that security can be reestablished.
The BBC's Jonathan Marcus in Paris. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
If you own an iPhone or an iPad, chances are part of its early life was spent in China, where Apple makes a lot of its products. Well, a prominent environmental group there has just released a report accusing Apple suppliers of widespread air and water contamination. It's calling on Apple to identify its Chinese suppliers. But as Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports now from Shanghai, Apple is not saying much.
In a video released with the report, a sad violin plays behind an old man navigating a waterway of polluted, milky white water. According to the report, the water he's paddling through is discharged from a factory along the Yangtze River that makes circuit boards for Apple. The man says, "This generation drinks polluted water. The next one will drink poisoned water." Ma Jun, the report's author, says samples of the water found the concentration of the heavy metal nickel to be 11 times the amount allowed by Chinese law.
You know, Apple is taking advantage of the loopholes in the management system of China, and they collaborate with all these bad polluters at the expenses of the environment and local public health.
In an email to Ma's group, Apple said several of the companies listed in the report were not Apple suppliers, but it wouldn't specify which ones. As a rule, Apple doesn't identify its suppliers. Ma's group is trying to change that. Apple did offer to hold a conference call with the group to discuss the report. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Spanish lawmakers vote tomorrow on a new constitutional amendment that would force the country to reduce its deficit and its debt. But Christopher Worth explains this morning, controlling spending in Spain is going to depend on what happens at the local level in the country's 17 political regions.
Spain's regions are a bit like states in the U.S. They draft their own budgets and make their own spending decisions. But when they spend too much, Spain's national government ends up footing the bill. Gonzalo Gómez Bengoechea is an economist at IESE Business School in Madrid.
And this is one of the biggest problems that we have in Spain, because there is actually no control over that part of the expenditure.
Take this gleaming new airport outside the small city of Ciudad Real in the hot, arid region of Castilla-La Mancha. It's one of Spain's several so-called ghost airports, built at a cost of over $1.5 billion. The hope was it would become a bustling travel hub serving Madrid, 140 miles away. Today, I walk through an empty terminal.
So I'm looking at the arrivals board here, and it's not even turned on. It's completely dead here.
Just a couple of flights go in and out of Ciudad Real each week. Even those flights are due to end in October. And the only thing keeping the project afloat is money from local taxpayers like Daniel Guzman.
I'm disappointed because they've taken our money and spent it on an airport for a city of just 70,000 people. There was no need for such a big airport.
Regional governments across Spain have racked up over $165 billion in debt. Economist Gomez Bengoechea.
The government may ask them to reduce the spending, but they can't force them to reduce the spending.
Ratings agency Moody's has threatened a downgrade over Spain's regional deficit problem. Edward Hugh, an economist based in Barcelona, says regional spending will derail Spain's plan to drastically reduce its national deficit.
And the problem really is that the deficit was the only thing in the eyes of investors that the Spanish government had to put on the table to show we are a serious country.
That is, serious about not defaulting on its debts and avoiding a bailout from its European neighbors. In Spain, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Throughout the day today, we're getting a look at August auto sales. We already have some Japanese numbers, and they are not good. Honda sales were down 49%. Toyota and Nissan also had sales drops. Those are being attributed to the Japanese earthquake and tsunami and the supply disruptions there. In Korea, actually, the car makers reported a little bit of a boost. I think they're benefiting from the loss in Japan. Mm. Still, the industry as a whole, and here in the United States especially, seems to be on the mend as pent-up demand takes precedence over anxiety about the economy. Here's Marketplace's Elisa Roth.
The good news is 2011 car sales are shaping up to be better than 2010. The bad news is we're still buying about 4 million fewer cars every year than we did before the recession. Paul Taylor is chief economist at the National Automobile Dealers Association. He says Americans aren't in a hurry to buy, but their cars are getting old.
That's driving a lot of customers in based on need, and they remain skeptical of an economy that's not fully meeting their expectations.
Used car prices are up, which Taylor says is helping new car sales, because used cars are so expensive now, a lot of people figure they might as well buy new. Jessica Caldwell is an analyst at Edmunds.com. She says there are usually big sales around Labor Day, and now is the time when dealers start making room for next year's models.
Generally speaking, we're in that model year sell-down mode, so for people wanting to get a deal on a 2011 model, it's really a good time to start shopping.
Taylor, the economist, thinks dealers will be sweetening incentives to build sales momentum through the rest of the year. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, we've got a new show. It's called Marketplace Index.
Indeed.
With David Brancaccio that we premiered earlier this week. And we'd love for you to give it a try. You can find it at our website, marketplace.org, or you can, of course, listen to it on a number of public radio stations, too, across the country.
And if your public radio station doesn't carry it, you should call them up and say, carry the Marketplace Index. It's supposed to air at the very end of the market close, right around 4:30 Eastern time. And it's a nice 4-minute show that wraps it all up in a nice little package.
Check it out, Marketplace Index. A new Associated Press poll out of Japan today finds that 6 months after the earthquake and tsunami that caused the nuclear accident at Fukushima, more than half of the Japanese people want to reduce their reliance on nuclear energy. Well, here in the U.S., just the opposite is happening. Last month, regulators in Georgia approved new construction of nuclear power plants. In Florida, there's discussion going on about the economics of restarting an old nuclear plant. Robin Sussingham reports now from Station WUSF in Tampa.
This summer, Progress Energy did something extremely rare. The company invited reporters into one of its nuclear plants.
In light of the events of Fukushima in Japan, we felt it was important to invite the media in to become transparent with our business.
That's John Frank, vice president of the Crystal River Nuclear Plant. It's about 80 miles north of Tampa. Frank had to answer questions about more than nuclear safety. The larger concern here is that this plant hasn't generated any power since 2009. That's when workers cut a hole in the thick concrete containment wall so they could bring in a new steam generator. That work created cracks in the concrete. Repairs took more than a year, and when the company was almost ready to start producing power again, it found more cracks. Vincent Dolan is the president of Progress Energy in Florida. He says no other nuclear plant has had these problems.
It was a unique sort of situation, one that was not something that we think we could have foreseen.
It's going to cost about $1 billion to repair. The company and its ratepayers are hopeful, but not certain, that insurance will pay for it. John Moyle represents industrial users who want to keep rates low. He says the Crystal River nuclear plant reminds him of an old Tom Hanks movie.
The money pit that just keeps going and going, and more money keeps going in.
The repairs will be expensive, but not doing anything would cost more. The plant provided 10% of Progress Energy's power, and President Vincent Dolan says nuclear energy is cheap, cheaper than replacement fuels like natural gas.
It would essentially cost $300 million more per year to consumers to not have that plant be available to us to run.
And that cost is based on today's natural gas prices, which are low. But that price could easily change, and consumers worry as the unplanned costs pile up. In Tampa, I'm Robin Sessingham for Marketplace.
Well, now to the world of retail. We heard this morning of strong sales last month at Target, Costco, and Limited brands. Mm-hmm. That may push some of these retail chains to look for expansion opportunities. Maybe they want to open up some new stores.
Yeah.
Last year, Steve, there was so much vacant store space that commercial landlords were cutting deals left and right to attract tenants. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, the cheap retail space isn't as easy to find anymore.
If it seemed like every time you turned around last year, another store popped up, you are not mistaken. More than 5,000 temporary outlets opened and may have closed. Over 600 of those belong to Toys R Us. Faith Hope Consolo is a real estate broker.
There was a lot of vacant space, and they had an opportunity to fill those spaces at a very nominal cost. But that's not what it's about today.
Toys R Us says it's cutting back on holiday pop-up stores this year, and it may not be the only retailer. Eric Anton is the president of Pop-Up Insider. It matches landlords with temporary tenants.
Retail values have come up over the last 12 months, so maybe we'll be seeing more long-term tenants signing leases, so maybe fewer pop-ups.
Anton says pop-ups will live on as concept stores that build buzz and test consumer preferences. But last year's bubble may have... I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Finally today, you'd think, Jeremy, Apple employees would have learned just to leave the iPhone prototype at the office. I mean, my goodness. Last year, you heard about the story. Of course, a group of workers reportedly went out to this Silicon Valley bar, maybe had a little few too many cocktails, and they left their prototype iPhone 4
Oops.
Behind, right?
Before Somebody it picked had come it up. Out.
Before it had come out, right. This was just a prototype phone. And somebody picked it up. Somebody sold it to Gizmodo. What did they pay, like $5,000 or something for this prototype? Well, it appears to have happened again.
Oh.
CNET is reporting there was a frantic effort just a month ago to find a special iPhone 5, a prototype of the iPhone 5 that was left in a San Francisco tequila lounge.
What is with these Apple employees and drinks?
I know. I don't know what's going on there. The owner of the lounge says he remembers a man kept calling over and over and over again about leaving his phone there. Did you find a phone? Did you find a phone? And the guy was like, no, I didn't find a phone. He didn't realize it was an Apple employee. He says, though, he tells this to CNET, quote, I guess I have to make my drinks a little less strong.
Indeed. Although, Steve, I have to say, when I hear these stories, and when I heard the first one, even before this one that you just told me, it does seem sort of like there's a possibility that this was a purposeful
Apple. Oh, you think
Apple,
so? To put it in the news?
That they want to leak it out, get
Are
a little
Are you saying
excitement.
They got us hook, line, and sinker? Is that what
think
you're
they
saying?
Might. I'm just saying.
Wow. Right? Yeah. I can't believe this.
No, not Apple.
Not Apple.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Thursday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.